Welcome to Brewing One Ear and Out the Other. I'm Pranav.
And I'm Nakin.
Our guest on today's podcast is John Tabas, founder and CEO of the Boogs Company.
We had an opportunity to talk with John on January 23rd about his positive experiences with the UCLA Anderson Network, thriving at Disney through the recession, and the success and incredible work of his own company, the Boogs.
So without further ado, here is our interview with John. Hi, John. Thanks for joining us on Brewing One Ear and Out the Other.
Pumped to be here. Thanks, guys.
Awesome. Because this is a UCLA-themed podcast, one of the things we wanted to do was ask you one of the questions that current applicants have to answer as part of the application.
Sweet. It'll
serve as a great introduction to our listeners. So the prompt that we selected for you is, what have you done to make your school or community a better place?
So am I supposed to answer this as if I'm in high school?
No, you can answer it now.
Today.
Today's world, yeah.
Okay. That's great. So I guess the thing that would be most wheelhouse for a college application, the answer there would probably be some of the volunteering I do for some of the organizations around town. I think the two that would be most relevant would be, I am on the steering committee, the board of advisors for NABO LA, which is the National Association of Women Business Owners. And so I serve as a consultant advisor to the leadership team there to help them steer their mission to have the most impact for small business owners that are women. So that's a great organization. Love helping them however I possibly can. And then another place that I volunteer my time is with the University of Notre Dame Athletic Department. I'm a brand strategy advisor to the group there, which is super fun. Not this community here in LA, but that community certainly in South Bend, Indiana. The answer that I would not give to the college application review folks would be, I'm a strong buyer of local craft brews. So I support the community by paying tax dollars and supporting small local businesses, especially Firestone over here in Venice.
Yeah, I definitely hope you wouldn't write that as a high schooler perspective.
Well, I mean, or maybe that would just make me super epic as an applicant. Like, this guy is talking about how he goes to the bars and buys a lot of beers. I don't litter. I pick up litter when I see it. I don't trash birds or limes. I use them responsibly, and I don't often ride on the sidewalks. But I do not wear a helmet, so that's a ding against me. That would be my answer. Am I in? What happened? Did I make it?
I think you're accepted. We got to get you on the UCLA Athletics brand advisors, because we're leaking football players left and right, and I think Sharif is just leaving the basketball team. So we got to sway your allegiance to your MBA school.
Well, you know, I got to tell you, school leadership is real hard. And I think in today's world, school athletic leadership is really hard. And what I think a lot of people get it wrong, and I think this is my perspective on politics as well, by the way, is that too often it's about, have you played at the school, or do you really donate a lot to the school, or whatever it might be, instead of like, let's find a great operator who's really good at doing this kind of stuff. And that happens in all kinds of walks of life, not just school administration. But, you know, I would use Jack Swarbrick at Notre Dame as an example. That guy was on like the U.S. Olympic Committee and a bunch of other things. He was operating large sports organizations. If I'm UCLA and I look at like, where are we lacking in certain areas, I'd be looking at like, okay, where do we find leadership like that, whether it's a coach or an administrator or whatever it might be. Because too often we're kind of like, oh, like, you know, USC. I love Lynn Swann. I'm from Pittsburgh, so like, I'm a big Lynn Swann fan. Would I hire an ex-NFL wide receiver and that is the qualification to run my athletic department? My answer is an unequivocal no. And so sometimes there's just a misalignment because people think people love things and they care a lot about things that are going to be great for the organization, and that's not always necessarily the case.
So,
but speak. If you know them, tell them to give me a call. I'm here to help.
Who will?
So speaking a little bit about your experience helping as a branded advisor, I want to talk a little bit about your time at Notre Dame in undergrad. So we found out that you both walked on to the football team and were at the in the Glee Club at Notre Dame. So we're hoping
first one ever. First one.
Describe how you ended up getting interested in those two very different activities.
Yeah, so I've that way my whole life. I'm like the guy who is friends with everybody, but not good friends with anyone, because I like all the people and all the things, and they generally didn't like each other very much. So I was the weird one who would like balance between, like in high school, I was in the choir, like two choirs, and I was in the musical, but I was also the captain of the soccer team, which won state championship. I was on the track team as well. I was also in the like scholars program or whatever. I just like to do all the stuff. And I generally find interesting and fun things in most people, unless they're jerks. Most people aren't jerks. So at Notre Dame, that just continued. I was on the school council. I led a project to launch this big statue on the campus to commemorate education, Catholic education in the 21st century. I walked onto the soccer team as a freshman and got cut. I had been singing a long time, and so then I joined the Glee Club. Loved the Glee Club, but then really wanted to be a rock star, so I started a band. It was called Sexual Chocolate. I don't know if that came up in your research, but it's a great band.
No, you buried it deep, deep down.
No way. I talk about this all the time. Not good quality music, but highly entertaining. We were mostly comedy and a little bit of music. And my cousin had kicked D1 football at Maryland, and his dad had been his coach for a while. So one summer I was like, hey, I played soccer. I got a leg. I'll try this. And so while I was in the Glee Club, I went and I walked on and actually made the roster. I went 20 for 21 in field goal attempts. Wow. My kickoffs were pretty decent. And then I was put on the roster over the summer, and they were like, hey, put on 10 pounds of muscle, come back, be ready in the fall. And then the coach who was like the walk-on coach actually left the school over the summer to go to some other school. And like, no one told us. So when I came back, they're like, who are you? And I'm like, I'm on the team. Like, there's like, nah, you could try out again this year. And I was like, nah, I'm not going to do that again. So that was kind of that. That was the end, the beginning and end of my kicking career was one off season. But it was fun. And then ultimately the band is how I met my co-founder, which is how I started this company. So ultimately, you know, it all worked out for the best.
Wow. We'll get into the books later on, but I guess the being interested in kind of two different types of activities continued with your major at Notre Dame with finance and computer applications then?
Yeah, that was mostly a journey of practicality. So the way I picked my major it's not the way I would recommend it, although you guys are great examples of you often don't end up doing what your major is anyway. But I went through and I said, okay, here's all, I knew I wanted to do something around business. I don't know why I thought that. Like you said earlier, who knows why we make choices when we're teenagers? Like, we don't know. So I don't know why I picked business, but I picked business. And I thought, what's the easiest seeming one for the most high, the highest average starting salary? And that was finance. And so that's how I picked finance. It's just like a pure ROI calculation. Least amount of class time, most amount of salary. And then I haven't had a finance job since school. But enjoyed it, met some really great people, some really super smart people at Notre Dame in finance, some of my best friends. And it certainly laid a good foundation for my business career.
And then the computer science part.
That was one where I saw the writing on the wall, the technology was the future, but I was never going to be a developer. I do not have the patience for the level of detail and logic that you need to be a developer. So I knew I was going to do that. So I thought having something on the resume that was like sort of tech forward looking would be nice. And there was a new program. It was a minor. It was like six classes or something, but just sort of gave you more than a rudimentary level of education around applications of computer technology. We had to do a little bit of coding. I did some C++. I still don't know what the heck we did in that class at all, but apparently I learned something about coding And the biggest thing I learned was I should not be coding. But that was a cool little like way to sort of slide in a bit of an interest. And then here I am running a tech enabled startup, decades later. And so it paid off in some ways.
So then how did you decide to get an MBA and then why Anderson? Did you still use your same ROI calculator, or was there kind of any other planning behind that?
Yeah, so I went to Bain & Company out of undergrad, a strategy consulting firm in Chicago, met some of my best friends in the world, had a great run there. And once you go to Bain, it's kind of like an assumed that you're going to get your MBA, although that's been changing more recently as sort of the trends have moved away from the degree in general. But at the time, for sure, if you were there 2 years, 3 years later, you got an MBA and then you went and got some job. So that was sort of my expectation. I worked at Bain for a couple of years and I worked in advertising for a couple of years. And I was looking around and I applied at a couple different schools. I applied to Kellogg at Northwestern in case I wanted to stay local in Chicago. It also felt a lot like me and the type of people I wanted to hang around with, which was smart folks, but like not hyper competitive, not cutthroat in the way that some programs can be, et cetera. But I really was not digging the weather. I was sort of struggling a bit with Chicago weather. I'd grown up in Pittsburgh. I'd been in places with snow and sleet and ice my entire life and was just ready for something new. I also had a pretty strong interest in sort of storytelling and creative industries. And so that leads you to sort of typically New York or LA. New York was not an improvement on the Chicago weather. LA was a great improvement. And so I applied a couple other places to Wharton, et cetera, but it came down to UCLA and Kellogg, and both were great. I thought they were really good fits for me, but I really wanted to check out LA and see if it was a good fit for me personally, for my career, and the whole entertainment thing. And so that's how I ended up choosing UCLA.
And so tell us a little bit about your experience at Anderson. What were you involved with on campus, and kind of what did you take away from your time there?
Yeah, Anderson was awesome. So it was a couple of things about just getting an MBA in general. It's like you're an adult, so you kind of know stuff, but now you get to be in school again. It's this amazing personal place where you're not a teenager anymore. You actually have some work experience. You understand the world in a way that you couldn't the first time around. And so you savor this in a way that's a little different, right? Because you have the time, you have flexibility with your schedule, you could explore things, but you have your feet under you a little bit. So I really enjoyed it a lot. I thought the people there were awesome, just as I had expected from my interviews and spending time with the faculty and the other prospective students. Great people, really sort of genuinely interested in everyone helping each other out to succeed, a lot of great teamwork. So really enjoyed the experience. My educational sort of part was more focused on marketing and entertainment because I came from finance and strategy. And so those were gaps for me. So got to take a bunch of great courses. I wrote a case for Sanjay Sood, who had started an entertainment marketing course when I was there. And so got to work on the Blair Witch Project, which was sort of a classic viral marketing story. One of the first trolls ever before anyone even knew what trolling was, which is pretty awesome. So the marketing stuff was new and different. Got to be Peter Goober, who runs Mandalay Entertainment, got to be his TA and take his class, sort of audit his class while being the TA, which is, and I got to walk into his office. Was no joke, 70, 80 feet long by 35 feet wide. And there was like a life-size Michael Keaton because he produced the original Batman.
Yeah.
And that was his office. And it wasn't even the main building. It was so amazing. So was really lucky to to sit on that class, watch him, learn about everything, that he had done in his career. And what I found in general, I tried to start my first business there. It was called, the Filling Station. It would be self-serve beer bar. Really not easy to raise money for a self-serve beer bar. We tried really hard, but my friend Jack, which you just visited the other day, is like the lead of all craft brew sales for the Southeast for Miller Coors. So like he's the beer guy now, which is pretty awesome. So it was a place where I got exposure to those two worlds. A lot of great networking. I mean, the network and the folks that we got to meet and be exposed to and build connections with was amazing. And I think the the biggest thing I took away was this camaraderie and teamwork orientation of the school. There's great academics and stuff too, but for me, the network and the people was really what made it special.
That's exciting. You pointed out Professor Goober and Sood as two professors that stood out during your time. You're now a guest lecturer at UCLA Anderson. How has that experience been?
I don't know yet because we don't start the class until March 30th. So we're prepping the class. We had to build the syllabus. We had to get it approved via the academic higher ups. We meaning Brian Farrell and I. Brian Farrell was is on the board of advisors for Anderson. Was CEO of THQ for 12 years. Scaled it up to multi billions of dollars. He's an epic CEO. So we've gotten to do the formulation of what we think it's going to be, but we haven't actually taught a minute yet.
Okay. Do you want to pitch the class then to our listeners?
Sure. Yeah. If you are in the school, or if you just want to sneak in, I guess, it's a class called, I don't know exactly what we'll end up calling it. It's precisely, but it's sort of toward the journey towards the entrepreneurial mindset or the entrepreneurial mindset or some version of that. And essentially the idea is, a lot of people talk about what it's like to be an entrepreneur. You know, you read about it in press, you watch it on Silicon Valley, you listen to people like me talk about it. But a lot of people that talk about it haven't done it. And there's a level of glamorization and a lack of understanding about what it actually entails. And knowing what those things are before you go try to do it can be helpful. It can help you decide if you want to do that or not. It can help you decide if you want to go work at a company that is earlier stage. And if you are going to go do it, it can help you move faster, make fewer mistakes, et cetera, et cetera. So the whole course is oriented around the sort of personal journey of what it is to be a founder, from how do you go from ideas to execution, to how do you build a team and fundraise, to what are the sort of leadership and psychological and sort of interpersonal challenges that come with being a founder, of which there are so many that no one ever talks about. And so really excited to bring that to the school and to the class, and hopefully everybody signs up and we're sold out. It's not the best time because I have a day job, so we're an evening class. So it's going to be for people that are night owls, but we're excited to bring it out and see how folks react to it.
That's exciting. I'll be sure to mention it, and I'll tell everyone you're giving out all A's. So hopefully your resume goes out the roof.
That'd be sweet. I appreciate the marketing.
So we're hoping also you could, and you kind of touched on this a little bit, hoping you could describe how you felt the alumni network was and how that really helped you early on right after your MBA.
Yeah, so I actually learned about my job through the Anderson Alumni Network. A non-alum, my old boss Bonnie, had reached out to an alum, and then that alum had posted it through the alumni message boards around this job, and it made its way to me on campus. And it was the perfect job for me. It was sort of bane in my advertising jobs, jammed together in an entertainment company at Disney. So it was exactly what I was looking for. And that job essentially came about because of the network. I actually then, a year later, helped my friend John, who was a classmate of mine at Anderson. He now runs a great branding agency called Innovation Protocol here in LA. We had an opening and I grabbed him, was like, hey man, this job's perfect for you. So I brought John in. And so we started sort of our own. And then my intern, she was a second year at Anderson, was an Anderson student. And then I ultimately hired her when she graduated. And so we had a Anderson pipeline kind of rolling through our group at Disney. And then also across, we were in corporate strategy, so we were internal consultants to all the different divisions. But then across the organization, we would find folks who are Anderson alums. And they'd be in positions of managers, VPs, directors, whatever it might be, and became sort of compatriots with us in the strategy group. And so really was a great connection through the entertainment world. I had friends that went off to work at agencies and other entertainment companies, have helped folks get jobs, they've helped me get jobs. And so that was a really great tight-knit network. Since leaving the Walt Disney Company and sort of diving into the startup world, it's been a little bit different because startups are inherently smaller enterprises, right? So I think in the history of the company here, I've hired a couple folks that were Anderson alums. Phil Irvine was our director of CRM for a couple of years. He was a class behind me. My VP of finance, Jeff Demke, for about 2.5 years was a class behind me in Anderson. And so have had opportunities to bring folks in here and there. But when you only have, you know, early on in the company, we had 6 people in the company and they were all under 25 and making not good money. Tough to hire MBAs. But as we've scaled, we've had an opportunity to pay back a little bit and make some hires.
Awesome. You mentioned just recently kind of you graduated around the time of the Great Recession. Several things about your time at Disney. I think you mentioned Disney had a similar culture to UCLA Anderson in the sense that it was collaborative. Also that you were one of 2 promotions during the Great Recession. Can you tell us a little bit about how the work was at Disney and how you think you stood out there early on in your career?
Sure. Yeah, Disney was great. I think we were a little bit sheltered in corporate, right? Corporate is a cost center, but it's a budgeted cost center. And as such, our P&L doesn't change massively, right? So we're sitting inside making all the rest of the business better if we can. And so in a lot of ways, that's a pretty protected space in a difficult economic time because our revenue didn't change because we don't have any revenue. And so there were benefits to that, that in retrospect, I didn't know were there, but were there just because of the function that we had. But I think at the end of the day, what led to my promotion and Jay, who is now at Microsoft, he's an epic rock star, Jay Victor, not an Anderson guy, went to Princeton, Princeton guy. But what I think led to our promotions in that time frame, we were sort of the two, was we grabbed things and ran with them and added value, and we kept adding value. So we didn't build big teams. We didn't hire massive groups of people. That's not how we got promoted. We essentially proved to our bosses that we would be good ROI for them. We could do more with less, that we could find ways to stretch budgets and to make impact without having to spend a ton of money because our budgets weren't huge because it wasn't, you know, the time in the economic cycle where budgets were huge. And so we just put our heads down and really worked hard. We were easy to coach. We tried our best to listen, although that was hard for me then. It's still hard for me now. But we really tried to do our best to get better for our bosses so they would be better at their jobs and then the whole division would move forward. And we also got lucky. We got some really cool projects that we did a good job on that then had impact. I worked on over-the-top television in 2008, you know, like sort of a decade before it really became a thing, but we got to talk about when we thought that was going to hit and we were pretty right. We worked on Disney's brand strategy around the world, China in particular, which obviously has been a massive growth area. So we got lucky in the sense we got put on some really cool projects that ended up having impact as well.
So you kind of touched on this a little bit at the end there, but we're a little bit curious about some of the work that your team got to do while at Disney. I think the last role you had, Director of Corporate Brand Development and Innovation is the title. Did you have an opportunity to work with Marvel at all or with ESPN and kind of what were some of the projects you got to work on with those?
Yeah, so our group was essentially an internal consulting group to the rest of the organization. So we'd be put on projects and some of those projects were evergreen. My team, because we focused more on sort of innovation and technology, ours were often sort of contained. It was sort of like, hey, let's understand what the adoption of iPads is going to look like over the next decade. Because at the time, iPads were new. Those were not a normal device for people to own. And so Marvel, I didn't work on a ton. I had some sort of small interactions with the team at Marvel. A good friend of mine, Amy, that worked there and is now at DC, she was essentially the internal brand manager on Marvel and got to do all the integration, all the brand strategy. She was super lucky. I think she eventually got Lucasfilms too, which made her even luckier because I was super jealous. But with ESPN, it was actually probably my second week there. And this is way back in 2005, six. It must have been late 6, early 7, right after I started, maybe 3-4 months in. And we got called to do a bunch of work with ESPN around sort of the transformation from a linear cable-based, you know, business into a more digitally based, digitally distributed content business. And reframing their web properties to be more consumer centric, et cetera, et cetera. So that was a cool one and a half year project around laying the groundwork for what is now, and I take no credit for any of this because their team built all of it, what is now the ecosystem of ESPN.com, Watch ESPN, all their digital properties and sort of the consumer journeys across those. So that was a really cool piece that I got to work with ESPN. Did a decent amount of work with ABC and helping try to define their brand strategy. Like, broadcast networks haven't traditionally thought of themselves as brands. It's been more of a distribution portal for content. But in a world where there is no longer everyone has on the TV on channels 2, 4, and 7 or whatever it is, having a brand can help you stand out in the space. And we're seeing this through Disney Plus now and Netflix. And now you're going to have the Peacock and all these other sort of vertically integrated brands straight to the customer. And so we did work with them very early, sort of a little bit too early on how could we define a brand strategy for ABC networks. And so lots of cool projects with ABC, a lot of stuff around technology, new technology adoption, like I said. The work that we did in South Korea and in China was fascinating. I'd never been to Asia. I got to spend a bunch of time in Shanghai and Beijing and in Seoul, learning about consumers there, how they thought about the Walt Disney brand and how they experienced it growing up. That was one of the coolest projects. Was just like, I grew up with it in the way that I grew up with it here. Wildly different in mainland China in the 70s versus, you know, my experiences here.
Like, as a kid, you would draw comics, you'd make short movies. How was your experience with Disney growing up and then now working there?
Yeah, for me, Disney was an unreachable fantasy land that didn't really exist. The only way I experienced it was cartoons on like Saturday mornings. My sisters went to Disneyland when they were in high school as part of the marching band, because that was like a thing they did. Everyone drove down from Pittsburgh on a bus to like perform in the Disneyland parade. I never got to go to Disneyland. Disney World, it would have been World. And so for me, it was like always sort of this pinnacle of corporate and creative success. It's the best you could ever hope for. And by the way, today it is exactly the same. It's still the best brand, the best company, the best execution in entertainment that has ever been. And so working there was like walking on the lot and seeing the statue of Walt holding Mickey's hand and like that being your life. And the dwarves held up our building every day was just literally a dream come true while I worked there. And it was a real honor. And anyone I've ever talked to, because the mouse can get a bad rap from folks at certain times or with certain bosses or whatever it might be, but Walt Disney Company as a employer and as a company and as a brand, I think is unparalleled in the world.
So how did your focus and your experience working at Disney help to influence like the ideation and the initial thought of creating Boogs? And how did you decide to transition from this, you know, large, famous company to with a steady paycheck to creating your own startup and taking this huge risk?
Yeah, so it did happen quickly. It took me a while to sort through what I thought I wanted to do next, which, as we've said before, often what you think you want to do ends up being not what you want to do. But it took me a little while. I explored the world of startups. I explored the world of early stage companies, talking to friends. I had, you know, people I worked with at Twitter and Facebook and spent time with them to ask them what their experiences were like. And so I took my time sort of learning about that. At the same time, I was exploring like what were my options within Disney. I loved the company so much. I thought maybe I'd get into an operating unit and sort of rise up the ranks there. After exploring that wasn't the right fit for me. I really wanted more autonomy and more control and say on what we would do. And I was way too young and way too inexperienced and not qualified to run any kind of division. So that was gonna take a long time if I sort of stayed put and trying to work my way up the ladder. And so as I explored different options, this whole startup thing became intriguing. I'd always had sort of side hustles. So there was always a project of some sort that I was doing on the side. I started a blog and I wrote for the blog. We got this blog to like 100,000 readers a month, but like it wasn't really a business, or I produced it and distributed an independent film at one point, or I had a nonprofit business that was sort of you actually see a lot of them now, the Roundup for Charity thing, where like at checkout, you can say to toss your change into your digital change into a charity, created that on paper, but never got it off the ground for lots of reasons. And so I always had that going on, and I was like, I really want to like go do one of these things and like control it and run it and launch it and build it. But I didn't know how to do that at all. And the LA tech scene was sort of finally taking off. You know, you had big growing companies like Shoe Dazzle at the time and Beach Mint and a lot of venture capital flowing into the area. And so it was like, okay, there's something real here now. And maybe I can actually go get a job. And so I started doing some networking, you know, again, Anderson folks, non-Anderson folks, friends of friends. And I was just generally getting kind of rejected. And, you know, the reason was pretty clear. And they were just like, you're a big company corporate guy. Like, you don't actually do anything. You just create PowerPoints. And that was not inaccurate. That's what I was doing a lot, by the way, but I wasn't producing any actionable things on a day-to-day basis. That wasn't my job. I was not an operator. I was a strategy guy. And so and this is something that anyone who wants to move from the corporate world into the startup world is going to face at any given point, which is that branding matters, and what it says on your resume and on your LinkedIn matters. And if I got an application from somebody from Disney right now, I'd go like, I'm not sure, because you work in this kind of environment, you're used to these types of things. And that's insane, because I'm the same human I was when I was at Disney, and now I run a startup. And so clearly that is false, but it is sort of our built-in biases. And then, by the way, if somebody works at Tesla, you might think they're super entrepreneurial because they work at Tesla. But they might have come into Tesla when they were like 7,000 people, or I don't know how many employees they have, but a large number of people. They might be a total corporate person. And so these biases we have based on where you come from stuff are real, and I was just getting just straight up rejected left and right. I didn't mind it so much, but I was just trying to change that perception, right? Change the perception. And I got really lucky when I applied to Shoe Dazzle the first time around. I met Brian Lee and Deb Benton and the team there, and there wasn't really a spot, but we all liked each other a lot. And then like 9 months later, there was a spot, and it was like, hey, John's great at this stuff. Let's get him. And so they hired me as VP of brand and strategy. And that was a really great fit. And so I'd done some interviewing with Twitter and different companies, and there's, you know, for me, I needed something that was late stage enough where I didn't feel like I was walking into a garage and hoping that it might give me a paycheck someday, because I had a kid and house and, you know, responsibilities. But I also didn't want to go to something that was a big company or a medium-sized company. I wanted that early trying to figure things out stage, and Shoe Dazzle was absolutely perfect for that. I didn't know anything about women's shoes. I really didn't care. I figured it was about building a brand, building a business, and that I knew something about.
Awesome. Before we jump into the Boogs, I just wanted to mention that we have a Valentine's Day giveaway. Mom, you don't have to enter. Don't worry. You'll get a bouquet of flowers. But the giveaway rules are going to be, please email us at bruin1ear, that's the number one, @gmail.com by February 9th with who you want to send the flowers to and a story behind your relationship. Maybe your relationship fail, where you guys met on campus. Nakan and I will pick the best story and make sure someone gets their bouquet on Valentine's Day.
Nice.
Yeah. Nice. And in addition to the giveaway, the winner will also have the great fortune of being serenaded by the sweet, sultry tones of John Tabas's melodious, I'm going to guess here, baritone voice?
No. One, I'm not singing to anyone. Two, I'm actually a tenor, but I was sick last week and my voice is like way deeper than it normally is. So I'll take the compliment though.
So what gave you the idea then to start with the Boogs? You mentioned your co-founder, you met him at Notre Dame.
Yeah, so we stayed in touch, good friends. He had a career in biochemistry research and then got his MBA and then went back to Ecuador and was running a flower farm. And I had just left Disney 3 months prior to go to Shoe Dazzle. And, you know, he was looking at ways to make his business better. It was pretty practical. He's like, hey, I can do a better way of distributing these flowers. I can make more money. It'll be better for the environment. And so he had sort of this idea of the supply chain, but he's a biochemist by training and an operator of a farm by trade. He's not a salesperson. He's not a marketer. And so I'm the guy he knows that knows how to do those things. So he reached out and he was like, hey, can you help me think about how we might get demand for this? And so in those conversations, he taught me about the business and where he saw just major issues with the way that this all worked. The way that flowers got from the farm to the end consumer is pretty inefficient. It's very wasteful. There's no data. There's no technology. And so as he was teaching me about that, I started spending time on like the websites that sell flowers. And my general reaction was like, these are horrible. These are not designed for me. They don't speak to me. I'm not excited to shop on them. And in one particular episode, I was shopping for my mom for Mother's Day in that spring of 12, I think it was. Yeah, spring 2012. And I went through a couple of different sites. And after having clicked on an ad that said $19.99, when I got the checkout, it was like $64. And I was offended. I was like, in what world is this okay? I don't go to the car lot. They tell me the car is $10,000. And then when I actually go to pay for it, it's $30,000. Like, yeah. I understand taxes, but not this. This is absurd. And so I was protesting, and I was like, I will not buy from your website. So I went to another website, and I had the exact same experience. And I went to another website, and pretty soon I was like, wow, this place has no brands that are in any way are the type of brands I want to shop. And my co-founder is talking to me about all these issues with the supply chain. So I went to him and said, hey, let's put these things together, man. Like, we're good friends. We trust one another. Let's just try to get this off the ground. And for him, it was just another way for his farm that he was running to sell more flowers. So for him, it was like all upside. Like, okay, sure. It doesn't go anywhere, whatever. I left Shoe Dazzle to start it. So I had some risk in it. But I say this all the time too. Starting a company is not that risky. It's really not if you can put some guide rails around it, right? If you start a company, you work on it for 10 years and it goes nowhere, that is a major impact to your life and your career and your earnings. But if you start a company, you can say like, hey, if I don't have traction in 3 months, I'm going to go get a job. Or if I don't have this milestone in 6 months, I'm going to go get a job. Risking 3 to 6 months of compensation in the grand scheme of life is not going to be what gets you to financial solvency or the island you want to own or whatever your financial goals are. It's simply not the thing that's going to make it work or not. And so I got real comfortable with it, with sort of saying like, hey, the risk is there, but I can kind of control it. And if I get this thing off the ground and it goes like gangbusters, great, I'll keep doing it. If it goes okay, it'll become a little side project and maybe we can make a little bit of income off of it. And if it doesn't go at all, I'll just go get a job. I'm pretty employable. I have a good resume. And so that's the way I thought about it. And so we just sort of took the leap, and my wife agreed to me going from making good money to no money. And she was going to like keep the lights on and be the breadwinner. And I would help a lot more with my son, who was 9 months old at the time. And I'd do all the household stuff while building the company in our house. And I did a little bit of consulting here and there to make a little bit of cash. And ultimately it worked out. So it was really that conversation between he and I around what he was seeing in the industry that was no good. And what I saw at the same time, we thought, wow, we could attack this thing from two sides and hopefully create a lot of value.
So what were your parameters?
So the first milestone was get it launched. We don't launch it by this date, you're not launching it. That date was the middle of November 2012. We launched on November 6th, 2012. So we were like, all right, we're launched. The second one was, does anybody shop it? Like, if we're in month two and we're doing $500 a month or something, no one's buying your product. Our sales grew really quickly. Went 8,000 the first month, 12,000, 20,000, 40,000, 100,000. Like, we grew really quick. In our first year, we did just under $2 million of revenue. So, okay, now it's going. And then after that sort of milestone, that was like 6 months in, it was, can you raise money so that you can actually pay yourself something? Not even what you made at Disney, but can we actually make this a business that can sustain our lives? Because at the time we were essentially pulling money out of savings and running up the credit cards, and that was not comfortable for either of us. So when we raised a seed round of $1.7 million, and I could give myself a little, like less than half of what I made at Disney, but more than zero. And so we set those milestones out in sort of 3 month increments. And as a couple, you know, more than even as the company, because no one else was working on it full time, as a couple, we said, these are what we have to achieve to continue working on this. And luckily, we were able to do that.
So you raised 1.7 in seed. I think now you guys have raised about 50 million altogether. Yep. But when you started with a $13,000 investment from friends and family. Was it harder to get that initial money from your friends and family than it was to kind of raise the seed and later rounds? And how did you pitch them?
No, it was way, the friends and family was way easier, but let's break it down for a second. JP and I put in 8,000 of it. So we raised $5,000 from friends and family. The biggest investment of the five was my sister, who put in 2. And she wanted to put in 4. And I wouldn't let her because I was afraid she was going to lose too much money. So it was really like, hey, would you throw in a couple bucks? Yeah, here we go. And that was sort of it. So that was pretty easy. But we also only raised $13,000, right? So was not really around. Raising institutional money, so much harder. We were in the midst of a bit of an e-commerce implosion in LA at the time. We had had a number of big e-commerce companies in the area go either belly up completely or sideways and merger or whatever. And so there wasn't a lot of like natural enthusiasm for e-commerce. And then floral, everyone kind of looked at weird because they're like, flowers, like why flowers? And if I look at the public comps, they're not that great. So why is this a revolutionary idea that's going to work? And so we had a sort of an uphill battle from day one. Raising money is not the most fun part of starting a company. It's become glorified as if it's the point, but raising money is effectively failing, right? You have to do it, but essentially it's a mulligan. It's like you get to try again for X amount of time. And if you don't get profitable on your own in that time frame, then you're gonna have to raise more money. And everyone goes like, yay, you raised money. It's like, yes, it's great that we did. It'd be a heck of a lot better if we didn't have to. And so I always take it with a bit of a grain of salt, but at the same time, it's the financing has enabled us to build the company to where it is today and enables us to have a shot to build the thing that we have, you know, in our minds as a long-term opportunity. So raising money is hard. I was up and down Sand Hill Road. I was up and down all across LA, really trying to build the relationships and help people understand what this vision is. And we got really lucky. We found some really great partners and they've been supporting us ever since.
So speaking of raising money, you had an opportunity to be on Shark Tank and try to sell those sharks on Books. And they all ended up passing for kind of some of the reasons you just mentioned, that flowers are not necessarily a sexy business, and there was concerns about the growth. Barbara even made a comment about she didn't like the name, and that's why she was out. But later on, Mark Cuban had said that Books was one of the companies he regrets missing out on. We were hoping you could talk a little bit about your experience there and how that kind of shaped your path forward in terms of raising money and the business plan.
Yeah, so Shark Tank was a great experience. They all rejected me for some real and some seemingly for entertainment purposes. I think high level, great experience, lots of great exposure. The sharks and the producers of that show are awesome human beings. I can't say enough positive things about the show. No one has ever said this, but I think the reason they didn't invest is that we were expensive. Compared to the average Shark Tank company, we were valued at the time around $7 million. And, you know, they're investing in companies that are valued at $50,000 or $100,000 and maybe $1 million at the high end. And so we were just a different kind of beast. And, you know, I've actually heard this from some of the sharks, you know, sort of anecdotally through other people over time, which is lots of folks come in there and say that they're going to build from X to Y and they're going to make it huge and it's going to go. And no one does. Literally no one does. And then we came in and we said we were going to do that. And it's kind of like, yeah, sure you are. And then we actually did. So they actually released a list of the largest revenue companies come out of Shark Tank. And we were number 7 on the list at USA Today. But I actually undercut our sales because we don't share our sales publicly. So we would probably be like number 3 or 4. And, you know, the feedback sort of was like, yeah, but how are we supposed to know that you're the one that's actually going to do that, right? Especially the season we were in, we were the first season where anything venture-backed came on. And by the way, the biggest success was Ring, which sold to Amazon for $1 billion. They're in the same, Jamie and Ring were on the same season. It's now a massive business for Amazon. Their no stung a little because it was on TV and it's sort of like you want to win when you're on TV. But ultimately, I had been told no by 150 VCs at that point. And we were still going. We're still raising, we're still building the business. And so, you know, it was just sort of another no. And then ultimately, you know, a couple of years later, we ended up doing Robert Herjavec's wedding flowers. And he came back around and wanted to learn more about the business and ended up investing anyway. And he likes to say that a no is just another route to a yes. And so in the end, I think We have a great relationship with Shark Tank. They brought us back on. They got us on 2020. That's where Mark Cuban said he regrets not doing the Brooks deal, which is like a nice little feather in my personal cap. But just a really great journey of and I mean, look, I'm really good friends with a bunch of investors who rejected us early, middle, and late because they're smart people, and none of them bat 1,000. If they did, they would own the world. If you only picked the winners in VC, you would own all the, you'd have all the money. And so it's a great community of folks. I think they're really interesting people with a really difficult job. And I think the Sharks have some advantages because they tend to see companies really early and they have this platform that makes the companies more valuable just by being on it. But at the same time, they're sorting through a bunch of information in a short period of time trying to make calls. So really enjoyed that experience and so glad to have had it.
You mentioned that the Boogs kind of would fall under number two or three on that list, and you guys have kind of been crushing the sales numbers. Can you speak to the values of the company in terms of responsibility and sustainability a little bit more, and why you think you're separated from the competition?
Yeah, so the problem my co-founder saw were the separation of the farmer from the customer. There's a bunch of layers between how the farmer operates and when the flowers arrive to the customer. And there's a bunch of things that farmers do that customers don't get educated around because they don't know where the flowers come from. There's just no way to trace them. And so his family farm in particular invested a lot in sustainability and responsible labor and living wages, et cetera, et cetera. He wanted to be able to tell that story to the end buyer, but there's just no way to do it. So we have a commitment to sustainability and fair labor practices, and we rely on some great partners like Rainforest Alliance and Veriflora to ensure that our flowers, when they come from the farms, are farmed in a way that they view as responsible. We do that for a couple of reasons. One is it's economically better for our business because we believe that people care about that and that they're going to shop that way. It's economically viable for our business because a flower grown in as natural a way as possible will last longer and create a happier customer. And then finally, it does separate us from everyone else. So we have a story to tell that others don't necessarily have to tell. And so what we think about it both from a personal responsibility perspective, this is the kind of company we would want to run. This is the kind of impact we want to have in the world, but also this is what our customers are looking for. And these businesses that invest in these things deserve to have more sales because they're doing it the right way. And so it sort of all comes back to that initial thesis around the supply chain is convoluted, complex, and confusing. And there's not really a reason why when we shorten it and make it more of a straight line, what benefits do we get from doing so? And how do we turn that into advantages for the business?
So you just kind of referenced this, and we were hoping you could walk us through some of those supply chain challenges to get the flower shipped. I know that we had read that about 1/3 to half of flowers die along the way in transportation. So how have you been able to cut out that middleman and really make the business happen?
Yeah, so the 90% of the flowers sold in the U.S. are grown in Ecuador or Colombia. Cheaper land, cheaper labor, but also much more consistent temperatures. And that's really how you get flowers to grow consistently. So California is the largest producer in the U.S., but most of the flowers sold in the U.S. come out of those two countries. There's a long and pretty well-established process by which they move from that farm to the end florist, and then from the florist to the customer. What we saw in that value chain in our opportunity was a way to replace a lot of those steps along the way with technology. If you know how much of a given stem you're going to need where and when, you don't necessarily need all these way stations by which the product has to sit there. So then you just have to figure out how can you ship the product through a supply chain where it's smooth enough and reliable enough that you can get the results you're looking for. And that was really all my co-founder. So he had sort of started to build this capability for his farm. And really what we did was we sort of piggybacked on the existing supply chain. That existing supply chain was shipping tens of millions of stems in really big boxes and crates and on airplanes. And we just sort of said, hey, could you just slot this little tiny box in there next to that big one and just take it for along the ride? It's gravy for you, shipping partner, because you're going anyway. And we could pay you a couple more bucks on the other end. And so that's how we got started, and we just sort of tested it using our partner farms shipping logistics platforms. They were already shipping things, different box sizes and whatever, but they had the shipping manifest, they had the import, they had the customs, they had everything sort of sorted out. And then over time, we just started to automate all that. We said, oh, that step there can be automated by putting this into the technology here. We can communicate this to this government agency here. Okay, let's. So we built the technology to handle a lot of those complexities and steps along the way so that it just gets more efficient, more efficient. And over time, then we perfected that such that today things can flow from Ecuador, Colombia, Chile, Peru, you know, straight into the US through customs into a customer, and we don't lift a finger.
The first flower that you guys had was a flower from a volcano. Kind of what gives you guys the inspiration for designing the various bouquets? You know, the color palettes, what's the meaning behind specific flowers? What's kind of the flower world that a lot of people don't know about?
Yeah, so I'm not the floral designer. We have a woman on staff who's an accomplished studio owner and floral designer. That's her job. So generally, the highest level, we ask her to do a great job. But what she does is she spends a lot of time with our merchandising team understanding what are the trends in the marketplace, what are we seeing out there, what types of colors and color combinations and you know, greens or whatever it might be are people gravitating towards. So to use that inspiration to build a collection for any given season, we typically merchandise around big sort of peak seasons. You have spring, you have Mother's Day, you have summer, you have fall, you have Thanksgiving, you have Christmas, wintertime holidays, and then you're back to Valentine's Day and repeat. And so that team works together really tightly with the farms themselves because the farms are also growing certain things. They're not growing everything. If you say like, oh, I want a white-red hybrid of this thing, they don't have it. It doesn't matter if you design it. We can't source it. So it's sort of a two-sided equation. It's what do we think people are looking for? And then what can we get in the volumes that we need? And so it becomes a creative, a merchandising design, pricing, and then financial calculation. And then also a shipping and logistics one, which is can we get that where it needs to go in the time it needs to be there and good quality or not? And so it's a pretty complex process. It takes up a lot of our team and a lot of our resources to get that right. As far as, you know, particular flowers or what they mean and just going into Valentine's Day here, look, if you're in a romantic relationship, send something red. You can send roses if you love roses, but if not, send a mixed bouquet of lots of different flower types and she's gonna love that. If it's a friend or a family member that is non-amorous, then don't send red. You know, keep it simple. Yellow is a friendship color. If you really want to date someone, don't send them yellow flowers. And yes, yellow is their absolute knockdown favorite color because you're straight in the friend zone if you're sending yellows. I think in general today, people love a lot of greens. They love a lot of plants, succulents, and those we have some bouquets that have succulents in them. Those are super popular. Protea, which are sort of alien-looking flowers, are really popular. So we have a massive selection on Bouques.com. There's literally something for everyone. And then if you just don't know and you don't want to know, you can either choose a designer's or a grower's choice, which is essentially just let us pick for you. And then we also have a new thing that we're testing right now, which is called the Quickie Order. Which is sort of like, hey, if you just want roses for Valentine's Day, just click here, put in the address, and you're gone. And so that's an option on the site too. It's sort of in the upper corner of the website at Bouques.com. So, you know, there's a million sort of underlying stories behind specific species of flowers and the way they smell and all those things. The average person, I think it's about, think about what your person loves. Get them something you think they're going to like and that speaks to your relationship, whatever it might be, and they will be thrilled to have it on their desk for 1, 2, 3 weeks from those.
Okay.
Perfect.
So, and knocking, you're getting yellow lilies, not red.
There you go.
I also wanted to say, ladies, if any of you are interested, Pranav is single. So shoot us an email and I will get you Pranav's address so you can send him some of those red roses for Valentine's Day.
Heck yeah, do it. All day.
And then in 2014, you guys had 5 employees. Now you guys are slightly under 100. Tell us about the change in culture, how you developed culture in your role in shaping it.
Yeah, you know, scaling a company, the ideas are easy. The early execution is hard. Scaling a company is the hardest part. Going from 10 people to 100 people, going from 100 people to 1,000 people, what I've learned in this journey more than anything is that the people that can do that are unicorns. It's amazing that people can sort of ride those waves and make those changes. Because influencing people is hard. Influencing people such that they influence people, such that they influence people, such that they influence people, and on down in an organization seems damn near impossible. And so I'm super impressed with people that can actually pull that off. You know, we were very early. There was five people. We sat down and we wrote down what we wanted our core values to be. We put them on the wall and we talked about them a lot. And those held us pretty good through like 40 people-ish. They didn't scale all the way to where we are now. And the biggest challenge with those original core values, those were core values that were built for a company of five. And by definition, the company that we were when we wrote those was a different company than we were when we needed them later. And so we also brought in new leadership who had different experiences, and they wanted to put their mark on what was important to us. And so you have to put something down. Number one thing you do is just write something down and try to adhere to it as best as you possibly can. In the early days, we had two. It was be careful and be hungry. Careful was spelled care-full, be full of care. So care about our farmers, care about our flowers, and care about the people that sit next to you. And the second one was be hungry. Just go after stuff. Make it happen. Those two served us well for a while. But like, again, the company evolved over time. Today, the way that we maintain culture is we try to hire people that we think fit into that culture. We have it in our space. You can physically see these things. We have trainings. And when people join the company, I do a thing called Books 101. I just did one right before this podcast, where we talk about these things and reinforce what they are. And then we use them in reviews and we try to, you know, systematize this to say, hey, are we on culture or are we off? And if we're off, why? None of it's perfect. And the reason it's not perfect is that we're all human beings. And it's not, you don't just point and you go. People come from different worlds. They have different worldviews. They have different contexts. Some came in recently. Some came in 4 years ago. Some folks are naturally that kind of culture. Some folks are not. And so it's really a big challenge to sort of keep the ship moving in the right direction. And no matter what, it's never going to be a straight line. It's always going to have ups and downs and twists and curves. And I think that's probably the hardest part as a founder and as an entrepreneur is you have this vision, you know what it's going to be someday. You expect it to go straight there. And it turns out that's just not how it goes. I had a friend of mine who was in the other day and he's like, look, building companies just is hard. If you're building a company from 500 people to 600 people, or if you're building a company from 50 to 100, it's all just hard because there isn't a blueprint for how your exact company at your exact stage with your exact people and your exact challenges is supposed to be run. And so everyone does their best to try to sort that out. And understanding that you're going to have stops and starts and ups and downs is literally just part of that journey. And for a young organization that doesn't have the foundation that a Walt Disney or a larger, more established company has, it's just riskier because when you do fall, it has more of an impact on the business, it has more impact on the culture, more impact on the people. And so I think keeping that true north in mind is really important. And, you know, we just keep trying to reiterate that messaging to say, hey, this is what we believe in. This is why we're here. And let's make sure we're aiming for that every day.
So you mentioned understanding some of those hardships of building a company. We were hoping you could tell us a little bit about your work as a member of Nambo and how you got involved and what you've kind of learned and taken from your experience both at Disney and starting your own company and how that helps you serve as a mentor.
Sure, yeah. So I help out with Nambo. I'm a mentor at Techstars and at Amplify, and I'm on the board of advisors of a couple earlier stage companies that are exactly in the shoes I was in 5 years ago. The Nambo relationship came about because of just a cold outreach from LinkedIn. The president of Nambo, I think she had read an article and she said, there's some skill set there that we think we could use here internally around brand strategy, setting up of our organization, the perception of it, et cetera. And she reached out.
Your feminine qualities probably stood out.
Well, and look, 80% of our customers are 90% of our customer recipients are women, and 60% of our buyers are women. So there's a presumed understanding of women. My wife would probably say, I don't understand women at all. But that's just, you know, that's my cross to bear. What are you gonna do? My wife loves me.
Can you give flowers from the boobs, or does she consider it like part of work and you have to do something else?
I don't just give her flowers from the booths, but there definitely is a subscription to our home pretty frequently. So we got involved that way, and I got to dive in there and understand with her, you know, through her presidency, what the organization was like and do my best to try to help steer. I think it's natural for me as a former consultant to be an advisory role. I enjoy the sort of coaching and mentorship part of it. And it's a light way to get more variety in the challenges that I'm seeing. We have a lot of our own, but this is a business I've been now running for 7 years. And so working with Nabo and their businesses, working with, I work with Skylar, which is a women's health and beauty company. I work with Avasar, which is a procurement technology company, just sort of keeps things fresh and changes things up and helps my brain sort of always stay firing around different interesting problems.
And then our final two kind of questions, take it back to UCLA. What was your favorite memory and who is your favorite Bruin?
Good questions. Good questions. So who's my favorite Bruin and what's my favorite memory? The memory one is tough. I've got a couple.
Did you put on that Batman suit from Professor Goober's office?
That would have been sweet.
Yeah.
That would have been sweet. So I think my favorite memory was, it was a mini entrepreneurial venture. It was my friend Jessica. We were like sort of bored with what was going on socially, but we wanted to do something like big with the class. We wanted it to be kind of simple. And one weekend we organized a swingers movie bus tour. Ooh. And so we rented a school bus. We bought two kegs. We stuck them on the school bus. We told everyone to dress up like they were in the movie Swingers. We charged everybody $25 a head. And we had them take us to all the bars, the Dresden, all around town, to all like the cool hip happening spots in the movie. And we had an epic night. I mean, this was a mess. We had like 50, 60 students all rolling around in this yellow school bus, drinking in between. We made like a nice profit for kids living on, you know, loans and scholarships and stuff. But that was probably my favorite memory because it was a bunch of good times with a lot of good people. Also loved the movie, so it was just cool to see those spots. So I think that was probably my answer to that one. On the Bruin side, you know, I think it's a bit of a toss-up. I think probably Sanjay Sood, because he was so impactful on my career. I could talk about the historical sports players and coaches and that, but I didn't have like personal relationships there. I didn't know them. I can be inspired by lots of words by lots of the famous people, but I loved Sood. Actually kind of get to work with him now as an adjunct professor coming up here in the spring, which is kind of cool. So I guess I would go with Sanjay, but there's a lot of great people at the organization. I could go deep in lots of different places, and they would all, you know, center around the Anderson School, but really just feel lucky to have a relationship with the school.
Thanks so much for joining us on Bruin One Ear and Out the Other. And before we let you go, feel free to give us a 30-second plug for the Books or something else going on in your life right now.
Sure. So two plugs. One is Books.com, Bouqs.com, like bouquet, but shortened. Valentine's Day is coming up. We've got some amazing flowers, some good deals. The best thing you can do is subscribe. If you give flowers on Valentine's Day, that's nice. If you give flowers on Valentine's Day and then once a month for the entire year, now you're playing a different level game. So do that. And then check out my podcast. It's called Give Them the Biz. It's a lot of this kind of chit chat around sort of anything and everything in the business world, not just startups. We cover the news. We play games. It is the non-serious MBA education that you never knew you needed. Cousin Bill is my producer. He's hilarious. He's a writer in Hollywood. Katie Rotolo is a producer. She's a producer on film and television in Hollywood. Great people. We have a good time. So check us out on Apple Podcasts at Give Them the Biz.
All right. Thanks so much, John, for joining us.
Absolutely, guys. Appreciate it. Go Bruins.
Thanks again to John Tabas for joining us on the podcast. Feel free to reach out to us with any questions, comments, or guest recommendations at bruin1ear@gmail.com and follow us on Instagram and Twitter @bruin1ear for updates about upcoming episodes and giveaways. And please make sure to subscribe and leave a 5-star review if you enjoyed learning more about cool Bruin. This is Nakin Bhandari signing off. And hopefully everything we talked about today didn't go Bruin one ear and out the other.